Welcome to our special Los Angeles Greens event for Women's History Month, Petra Kelly's Legacy. I'm Linda Piera Avila. To start the evening's program, I'd like to introduce Jody Evans, dedicated community and political organizer for the past 30 years, and recently co-founder of the very effective phenomenon Code Pink.
And so I want to introduce Clara Greensfelder.
Petra Kelly, I call her, in thinking about this, I came up with this title, she's a green visionary, she was a world citizen, but I also would say, even though it's probably not the best metaphor for an environmentalist, but that she was actually the pace car driver for the 21st century, because she really set the pace. So we'll have her driving a hybrid or a biodiesel car off into the future. She was an amazing woman. She was always ahead of her time. And I think this is one of the things about visionaries, is a little bit, as you know, she died a young death, a tragic death, and yet she blew like a comet across our sky. It was just astonishing what she accomplished in the 42 years I think she had on Earth. Amazing. She was, some of the ways she was ahead of her time. Many of you are probably familiar with the struggle of Tibet. It's been very much a prominent issue here in the U.S. for about the last 10 years. Petra first got involved in Tibet in 1971. Nuclear power, radiation, nuclear weapons, an issue that really broke. It was simmering here in California in 1976 when we had the first nuclear power initiative. It really hit the big time here in 1979 with the Three Mile Island meltdown. Petra Kelly became active against nuclear power and weapons in 1970. And this was really actually the beginning of her commitment to environment and peace, came around the issue of nuclear power and weapons. And it was a very personal issue for her. Like many of us, we get involved in politics not just always because of an idea, but because something strikes you at your core, something strikes you at your heart. I'll bet if all of you took a minute right now and said, okay, what was that thing that made me decide to join the Greens? What was that day where I made that decision to come to a meeting? What was that when I got involved in the movement against the war? Often it's something personal, something that hits you. You have a friend who's in the army. You have someone who's personally affected by radiation. Something hits home. There's a lot of reasons why people do things, but often it's very personal. And in Petra's case, that was the same. Have any of you had a chance to read any of her books? Thinking, yes, which one have you read?
The biography and then the Thinking Green.
The biography by Sarah Parkin?
Right.
And Thinking Green, which is, I highly recommend that all of you, if you get a chance, get this book, because it's out of print, but you can still get them from Parallax Press, or get them on the, and they have some here. This book really embodies her thinking. It's Petra in her own words, including how she got involved in the movement, the last few speeches that she gave, which, you know, she gave them all, she wrote them all out in longhand, and she also spoke extemporaneously. So this book was compiled with thousands of pages of her documents after she died, in addition to text and transcriptions of speeches, which were phenomenal, phenomenal flights of words. In 1970, her sister died. She had a younger sister named Grace who had eye cancer and died at a very young age. And Petra believed that she always wondered what was the cause of the cancer of her sister, who she loved so much. Her father, who was German, had left her mother and when they were growing up in Germany. She spent her first 10 years or so in Germany, in Bavaria, which is one of the more conservative parts of Germany. And then her mother married an American military man after her divorce to her German husband, Petra's father, and moved to the United States, where Petra then spent the next 10, 12 or so years of her life, which is one reason she spoke perfect English. She went to high school and college here on the East Coast. She was amazingly, of course, if any of you have traveled to Germany, you know that Ute could tell you, many Germans speak perfect English. You speak better English than we do, actually, often. But it's an amazing education over there. But Petra spoke English with no accent. If you ever met her, she spoke really, and she spoke an American English, not really a British English, because she had lived here. So her sister contracted cancer, and Petra's stepfather, had been in Hiroshima after the war as part of the cleanup team. And she wondered in her own mind if he was exposed to radiation in Hiroshima following the war, and if that was one of the sources of her her stepsister's, half-sister, really, cancer, because eye cancer at an early age is quite unusual. And to give you an idea of the, and they were Catholic, they were a Catholic family, so to give you an idea of the level of commitment that Petra had, talk about going to the top. Jody knows how to go to the top. Many of you in this room know you, when you have something, you go straight to the person who you think can change it. Petra was so passionate about doing everything she could for her sister, she got her an audience with the Pope. Now, they were devout Catholics, but she actually took her to Rome and arranged for her to see the Pope because she thought it would be a healing thing for her sister. That was pretty amazing. But after her sister passed away, she not only worried about had it been a result of nuclear power and of the nuclear fallout from Hiroshima, she worried that the radiation treatments that she had might have actually made the condition worse instead of better. So you're looking now at 1970, and I'd like to read to you what, in her own words, what she said about this. My sister, Grace, died of eye cancer in 1970 at the age of 10. I always wonder why such a beautiful girl had to die so young. Was it because of the nuclear power plants that kept breaking down near our home in Virginia? Or because her father, my stepfather, was in Hiroshima as a young soldier just a few weeks after the atomic bomb exploded? Was the cancer worsened by the radiation treatment she received? Now, remember, this is 1970. Okay, this is before Three Mile Island. This is before China Syndrome. This is when everyone is still looking at atoms for peace and that we're going to save the planet through nuclear power. When Grace died, I resolved to do everything in my power to inform people about the military and civilian uses of nuclear technology and to participate in whatever ways I could to campaign nonviolently against it. I vowed to dedicate my life to finding out why so many millions have become cancer patients and why we are all atomic hostages in this radioactive age. So that gets you a sense of where she started. And she carried the anti-nuclear theme, carried her a long way through her life. It went all the way. The very last major two conferences she went to, she started in 1970 working on nuclear power and weapons issues. In 1992, the last two public events she attended were the World Uranium Hearing in Salzburg and then the Radiation Victims Conference, which I believe was in Berlin. There were two major global anti-nuclear meetings that took place in the fall of 92. Largely in conjunction with another issue that had become very involved with Petra's life towards the end of her life, which was indigenous rights. As you know, most of the nuclear power and weapons development has damaged indigenous people all over the world. The uranium is mined on their lands. The nuclear weapons testing has been on lands of indigenous people everywhere, in the Pacific, in the Southwest here in the U.S., in the Kazakh region, in the Soviet Union. The French, of course, out in Tahiti in the Pacific, and the British actually test here in the U.S. on an American testing ground, which is the land of the Western Shoshone people. So Petra had become concerned about this, and as one of her many campaigns on human rights. So she was ahead of her time on Tibet. She was ahead of her time on nuclear power. She was ahead of her time on electoral politics. The Green Party was not her first entry into electoral politics. While she was here in the U.S., as a college student, Petra Kelly worked on the campaign of Hubert Humphrey for president of the U.S., and prior to that, Robert Kennedy. I think, now let's see if I can get these years correct. 1968, when, I guess, yes, Humphrey was the candidate.
After they finished off Kennedy.
Yes, and she had been working, she was so passionate about things. She was a student at the American University, and at that time she just had a way of having access to power. She found out that her scholarship that she had, because she was a foreign student, might be discontinued. And so she wrote, what did she do? She wrote Robert Kennedy. And she liked the Kennedys, she admired the Kennedys, so she wrote Robert Kennedy and said she might lose her scholarship, and could he help her out? And then before he had a chance to respond, she actually ran into him at a reception for foreign students, talked to him about it, and next thing you know, he was steering her towards foreign student scholarships, and she ended up staying. Similarly, she was impassioned about something. She met Hubert Humphrey somewhere and started corresponding with him when he was vice president of the U.S. and was sending him letters. And she sent so many, and they were written in longhand, and they were so articulate, that he started writing back. And they started this huge correspondence. And when he became a candidate, he invited her to join his campaign. So right from the very beginning, she understood that political power in the electoral arena was a clear component, tactically, of moving the agenda towards a progressive future. Another way she was ahead of her time was that she looked at the whole spectrum of politics. Many of us in the movement know there's been endless debates about, should we spend our time in electoral politics? Should we spend our time in civil disobedience? And I have many anarchist friends and others who will say, oh, you waste all your time in that electoral stuff. And then you have the electoral friends that go, Claire, are you really going to go to jail? That's such a waste of your time. Petra saw it all. She saw that the entire spectrum, from hanging banners to wearing outrageous T-shirts to getting elected to office to going to jail, that all tactics were valuable and appropriate. It just was a matter of what time, what tactic. And she did them all. It wasn't an issue for her. It was whatever it took to get the job done, whatever it took to get attention. She was way ahead of her time in that. The fact that you had, I don't know how common civil disobedience was in Germany, post-war Germany, not huge. It wasn't. It wasn't something, and yet she repeatedly was arrested in front of military bases. And paid a lot of fines for boycotting and protesting German complicity in American nuclear weapons that were placed in Europe. And finally, the interrelationship of issues was another way in which she was really a forward thinker. You know, you couldn't, about Petra, you wouldn't say she was a women's rights activist. She was a peace activist. She was an environmental activist. She was a justice activist. She was a human rights activist. She was all of those things. And in fact, it was her understanding of all of those things and the unique position of Germany in the post-World War II of a commitment from Petra and many others of a younger generation that not only would the mistakes of the past not be repeated, but it's kind of like out of the ashes, this phoenix of a new idea arose of the tragedy of World War II. Then you had this incredible new idea, an interrelational politics called green. And the important thing to remember, which I think for green activists here in the U.S., is one thing that you often get confused here, that people think if you're a green, that means you're an environmentalist. And the green movement already had a name here as green. I've been thinking about this, and part of Petra's legacy of maybe the green movement in this country should rename itself as the new green movement, or the 21st century green movement, or something, and seize the time with the media and redefine the green principle, because the 10 key values cover it all, cover the whole territory. And the thing to remember about the German Greens is it started as a coalition. There were women's rights activists, peace activists, social justice activists, environmental activists, anti-nuclear activists. It was a coalition of all the components, and Petra, being tireless, visionary, and seeing the whole nine yards, worked on them all. And so she knew everyone and was part of the group that could expand it and pull all these people together. And I think that's another, but it's something that the green movement in this country can take a look at, is how do you formulate a green movement here that really looks like all the issue areas that are reflected in the 10 key values. And in 88, during the Jackson campaign, I argued to many people that I felt that the Jackson campaign, in spite of its proximity to corporate America, offered the closest thing to a green movement that we ever really saw in this country. It really was a rainbow. I was a delegate for Jesse in 1988, and we had everything and everyone. We had environmentalists, we had gay rights activists, we had our youngest delegate was an 18-year-old Palestinian college student. I think our eldest delegate was Rosa Parks, who was one of the delegates. And, you know, those of us like myself who've been involved in the Kucinich campaign and others here, I'm sure you were involved probably with Ariana's campaign and Dean's and some other the progressive movements. Try to imagine what it was like in 88 to have 1,500, one-third of the delegates at the convention. It was incredible, and it was a progressive movement inside the Democratic Party. So I think one thing that the Greens can take a look at is we often look at the German model and say, wow, they made it happen there. Well, they had two things that were very different, and Petra embodied both of those. One was that they really were a multi-issue movement. And if you look at even how the green started in Europe, in France, Brice Lalonde from Friends of the Earth, Les Amis de la Terre in France, an ecologist was one of the leaders there. Also in France, Solange Fernet, who's a longtime feminist peace activist, represented the women's movement and the peace movements. She's very involved in the Greens in France. They come from other movements, they're not just the ecological movements. Human rights, social justice, Petra's background, and on and on. So you had a diversity of people working. The other is the thing that they had in Germany that we don't have here, of course, is the parliamentary elections. And it only took a threshold of 5% for the German Greens to be able to move into power in the Bundestag. Whereas here, 5%, you get access to the ballot. You don't get automatic representation. So I think it's to take a look at what a green strategy for the U.S. would be is one of the legacies that Petra leaves. She had a green strategy that worked for Germany. But a green strategy for the U.S. has to reflect the conditions of the U.S. I read you the quote from where she started with radiation. To give you an idea of how she stayed current and ahead of her time, I want to read to you what she had to say about the first Gulf War. In one of the last essay in this book, which has a fabulous title, If There Is to Be a Future, It Will Be Green. Petra, this book she passed on in 1992. The Gulf War, as you know, the first one was in 1991. This is what she had to say about it. The macabre scenario of Desert Storm proved many of the warnings and predictions we Greens have been expressing for so many years. In the almost prophetic peace manifesto we published just after the Green Party was founded, we highlighted the devastating consequences of a consumer lifestyle and manufacturing methods that are based on the steady flow of natural resources recklessly squandered, leading to the violent appropriation of foreign raw materials. In this light, the Gulf War was a harbinger of future conflicts that will arise in the global struggle for increasingly scarce natural resources. She wrote that in 1991. She could already see the future. So here is someone who looked ahead all the time. And she had a very unusual upbringing, as I said. She was born in Bavaria, a historically conservative part of Germany. And her U.S. mother, her mother married a U.S. serviceman after a divorce. One of the interesting things about Petra also is, as a global citizen, she was about exchanging information not just between movements, but between continents. She came of age in the 60s in the U.S. She saw the social movements of our time, Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King, the anti-war movement. She saw that effect and the impact that it made. She took that back to Germany, and that belief that civil disobedience, social movements, can really make a difference. In an incredible twist, it was the Europeans who really reignited the American peace movement in the mid-80s, really early 80s, around the nuclear freeze. One of the most amazing things that happened, and a lot of history comes down from triggering events. You look at someone like Petra, she had strong feelings, strong passion. She took everything seriously. And she also had a way of seizing the moment. In 1979, a historic decision was made by the U.S., which was, as you may remember, during the Cold War, right before Reagan was elected, Carter was president, we were going crazy down the path towards more nuclear weapons. In those days, we were making 3 weapons a day, 3 plutonium warheads, 1,000 a year. We had gotten to the place where there were 50,000 warheads in the U.S. How many of you worked in the nuclear freeze campaign? You may remember our rap, which was, we have 30,000, they have 20,000, enough is enough, let's stop. But think about what that meant. At Rocky Flats, in Pantex, they were cranking out 3 nuclear weapons a day, 3 plutonium warheads. And where the shit really hit the fan was when, as part of, and remember, Carter was president. It was actually Carter that signed Presidential Directive 59, which authorized first use of nuclear weapons. They did something that was amazing. Here, finally healing from World War II. The Vietnam War is over. People feel like maybe we're pulling back from a world at war. And however, the Cold War is heating up. Conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The U.S. convinced the German governments, the European governments, to allow us to place Cruise and Pershing tactical nuclear weapons along the border in Europe, in Western Europe, targeted at Moscow, St. Petersburg, targeted at the Eastern European bloc. These weapons took 6 minutes to arrive at their target. Hair trigger, a mistake, and you've launched an all-out nuclear war. 1979, those got deployed. for the first time since World War II, really, you saw massive demonstrations in Europe against America. And they weren't just against America, they were interesting. They were bilateral. They were complaining about the U.S. and about the Soviet Union, who were catching them in the middle. It looked like Europe, of all places, was going to be the battlefield once again, only this was going to be a battlefield that nobody would return from. No Marshall Plan, no recovery, nothing could bring back a world devastated by nuclear war. And then we elected a president here, Ronald Reagan, another former governor of California, a movie star. History does repeat itself sometimes, guys. So, which is another reason why we all have to get engaged in electoral politics this year. Reagan was elected and started talking about a winnable nuclear war. Europe was in an uproar. It was, they couldn't believe it. That it's one thing that there was a war that was started in Europe that took place there, but for the U.S. and the Soviet Union to decide to take out their differences on each other by destroying an entire continent of which people had no choice was unacceptable. And you started to see huge marches. And where Petra came to prominence was in 1979. There was a large march in Bonn. And it was huge, this huge mobilization. Well, I think it was, yeah, I guess it was 79. And she was a major speaker there. And she suddenly hit the stage. She was impassioned. She was in the right place at the right time. And remember, whenever Petra spoke, she brought in everyone. If you were a feminist, you could relate to what she said. If you were an anti-war activist, if you were environmentalist, if you were a peace activist, whatever you were doing, she touched on it in her words. And everyone felt involved, and she showed all the connections between all the issues. But it was unthinkable that the U.S. could do this, and especially because she considered herself friendly towards the U.S. She had lived here, she understood it, she liked Americans. So she believed that the American political process could change. After that demonstration in Bonn, there were a series of demonstrations all over Europe. And wherever they were, Petra was there. If it was a sit-in, she was there. If it was a rally, she was there. There are countless photographs of her. I think there's one here. There she is with her partner, Gerbastian, at a sit-in in front of a military base. There she is speaking in a rally. Here she is. She liked to wear this military cap with the sunflowers, the symbol of the German Greens. But if there was a demonstration to be had, she was there. She was often one of the lead speakers. And she was so articulate. And many women were inspired by Petra's brilliance and her speaking up for women and for, but not just saying, she never said, because I am a woman, this is why. She was a world citizen. It was because she cared about all these issues. She never boxed herself in one place. So these demonstrations were so huge that it reignited the American peace movement, because what could you do? They were demonstrating in Europe, 100,000, 200,000 in the streets of... In fact, Michael knows as much as anyone. You wrote that book, 16 Weeks with the European Greens. I mean, what was your impression of the... People must have talked about that, how that movement... Oh, did I finish? Okay, yeah. It's really amazing how that happened. And then at that point, we in the U.S. picked up the nuclear freeze movement. Largely, many of the founders of the nuclear freeze movement, which was a huge American movement, were inspired by their European colleagues. So again, Petra then ended up having an impact, along with her other European colleagues, on the movement here. And when it took off here, it was an amazing time. Those of us who were involved, we managed to change the perception of the American people towards nuclear weapons. By the end of the nuclear freeze movement, by 85% of the American people were opposed to nuclear weapons, even actually by 83, 84. And the California movement was one of the largest. However, we had a major problem. 85% of the people were still afraid of the Russians. And that's when a next phase of Petra's work and a lot of us here in the U.S. started. She was someone that Mary Caldor, the member of the Labour Party in England, said about Petra, that she practiced détente from below, which means that citizens from different countries would get together. If the governments weren't going to do it, the citizens would do it. Here in this country, we've tended to call that citizen diplomacy. And if you looked at the time, around 83, 84, everyone was against nuclear weapons. People weren't, but they were afraid of the Russians. You had a massive movement of Americans going to the former Soviet Union to start working on this détente from below. If they can't get it together, we'll get it together, and the people of both countries will prove that we can end this, that we're not going to be mortal enemies. Well, Petra was way ahead of that. She was already doing it. One of the things that's not as well known in this country, in the Greens, that here in the U.S. that she did, was she pioneered relationships with Eastern Europe, and especially with East Germany, with activists there who in the 70s and 80s, especially when she was in the Bundestag in 1983 to 1990, that because she had a diplomatic passport, she was able to pass unchecked through the borders. She brought copy machines and cameras and typewriters. And I worked some in the former Soviet Union in that period from 86 to 90. They didn't have anything. Anything you could bring to the Eastern Bloc was amazing. We brought in videotapes and cassettes and computers and everything you could get your hands on to help the independent movements on both sides. And there were some members of the East German Greens who said that really she was their lifeline. And she took those kinds of risks because she saw that citizen to citizen could do that. Of course, at that point, she was even in the government and was able to do more. But in a way, I would say that Petra was a co-creator of the revival of the American peace movement. She was visionary, looking beyond blocks of East and West, and the conditions for that work were pretty horrifying at that time. If you just remember, I don't know how many of you can remember back, but to how risky it all seemed, that if you made the wrong move, that a war could break out. So really, when the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty was signed, when the cruise and Pershing missiles were rolled back with huge, massive movements here in the U.S., in Europe, it was really a victory for the movement. And it was a victory for Petra Kelly. And Mark Hertzgaard, the journalist who some of you may know, he's on NPR, Living on Earth, and he's written a number of books about nuclear power, but also one called Earth Odyssey. He writes an afterword in this book about Petra's life. And one thing he said, which I totally agree with, is that the movement really fell down. He doesn't quite put it this way, but he said that George Bush, the first, basically claimed that he ended the Cold War. You know, he was the president when they signed that treaty, the INF treaty, that took the cruise and Pershing missiles out of Europe, took them off hair trigger alert, no more 6 minutes to midnight. But it wasn't George Bush. It was the American movement. It was the movement between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union. We created the conditions where the Americans could accept the idea that the Soviet Union might not be their enemy. And if there was anyone, Marx says in his book, if there was one individual in the world who could lay claim to having been the banner carrier, the visionary, the policymaker who ended the Cold War, it was Petra Kelly. Through her work on starting in 1970 on nuclear power and weapons, through her work in getting into electoral politics in Germany, through her work as a visionary working with Eastern Europe. And yet, this is something that we really have to learn how to do in our movement. If they asked me to talk about Petra Kelly's legacy, one of the legacies that I think, and it's why I'm so happy to be here tonight, is that we have to talk about what we did right, about the victories that we have won. And it was a global citizens' movement, in particular a transatlantic movement of American activists and Europeans that brought an end to the Cold War, created the conditions where the Americans could believe that a Gorbachev existed, that Americans could believe that that it was possible to take our weapons back and that it might actually work, to believe that the Soviet Union and the Eastern Europe were really third world countries that were very poor and that needed development more than they needed nuclear weapons. And in fact, maintaining the arms race was bankrupting them. She saw all that. She carried that banner early. She carried it high. She organized many people. So I agree with Mark. If there's someone who should be laying claim to the having been the banner carrier for ending the Cold War, it would be Petra Kelly. So think about that. That's and then the Greens have a legacy there. You have a legacy of having had an impact on global politics, and we need to claim our leaders. One of the issues that was very hard for her, and it's always been a problem in progressive politics, was constant questioning of leadership. It's that balance between is democracy equal that there will be no leaders? What do we do with our leaders? What do we do with our visionaries? Do we recognize them? Do we vilify them? Do we keep them around? Do we push them away? Do we like them when they work for the group and not like them when the same qualities that make them a good leader also make them a little difficult to be around? And that was definitely something that plagued her. She was a workaholic. She worked night and day. She was very opinionated. And as some of you may know, when they first got seats in the Bundestag in 1983, she, along with Otto Schily, was one of the two spokespeople, which gave her an incredible national stage. But the Greens decided to be democratic and kind of like term limits here. My feeling about term limits is I don't think they've made anything more democratic. In fact, they've just given the lobbyists more control in Sacramento. There's different opinions about that. But when it came time, her turn to step down from being spokesperson, she didn't want to do it. She said, well, I'm more effective. I have this. And it was a struggle. Like, she said, but I've got all this experience now. Why should I step down now? And I think she did have to step down. But then they came where there was term rotation, when the Greens, you were going to not stay in more than one election. Well, she refused to step down. When they asked her to get off the list, she didn't do it. She was arguably the best-known Green in the world. To this day, I would say. Of course, now that Yasha Fischer is the foreign minister, certainly he has a lot of... But to some degree, wouldn't you agree she would be the best-known Green, at least at this point, in the world, and created that by being in the leadership. So it's a balance. How do we stay in dialogue with our leaders? How do we elect them to office and then not just throw tomatoes at them once they get there? It's a tough call. And I think that's one of the things that we still need to be developing with our progressive politics. And part of her legacy is a sad one, in that, as you know, when she passed on through kind of a mysterious death, that it's believed to have been a murder-suicide, that her they're not sure if it was a suicide agreement or if, in fact, her partner killed her and then killed himself. Some people also think it might be a conspiracy, that possibly the East German secret police, it's really hard to know. They left no note. It was incredibly sad. The general realm of thinking is that once, and this is the other side of it, is one thing that part of Petra's legacy that we have to remember is the dark side she left us, which is she was campaigning for a sustainable world, but she didn't have a sustainable life. She worked round the clock. She was in poor health. She had a kidney disease that left her with only one functioning kidney, which why she always had dark circles under her eyes. And basically, Gert took care of her, her partner, who'd been an amazing man himself. In 1980, he resigned the German military in protest of the Kruse and Pershing deployments. He was a general. He'd been a career military officer. He was about 25 years her senior, and started Generals for Peace in Europe. But in the last year of their life, when they lost power in the Bundestag in 1990, they lost all the infrastructure they'd had. They had, Jody was telling me, when she and Jerry went to, at their invitation, went to the Bundestag and visited Petra, they had money, they had offices, they had ability. When you're elected in German government and have a party that gets there, you also get a foundation. And you can do your own foreign aid. It's amazing. So they were able to send money to NGOs around the world. They were able to fly people in, and they were incredibly well organized, and they could hold international events. When they lost that platform, when the Greens were voted out of power in 1990 and didn't get the 5%, they lost all that infrastructure. Now, they maintained some foundations. They maintained some money. But because of splits in the party and some bad feelings, they did not give Petra and Gert any grants. So they suddenly went from having a salary and offices and staff to having nothing. And yet they had created this huge world of activity. They worked with people from the Dalai Lama to Fritjof Capra here in California to dissidents in Eastern Europe. They traveled all over the world. And that, again, they were somewhat isolated at the end. They were more appreciated, as some of your activists know this, outside of their own town, outside of their own country in some ways, than they were appreciated at home. Because, you know, it's at home is when you have all the struggles. So how do we find a way to work together, to work in politics and in coalition and in our own groups and not have those struggles? When they died, it was, Gert had been hit by a car and was feeling weak. He had said he didn't know how Petra could survive without him. He was not feeling well. There was some belief, perhaps, that he felt that he could not go on much longer and that he couldn't bear to see her struggle without him. That is basically the popular opinion, that he was just terrified of her trying to exist without him, and he felt he couldn't go on. But when you think, they weren't discovered for 2 weeks. They were in such isolation from their own movement in Germany that no one came by to see them for 2 weeks. Can you imagine that? Now, people were expecting them, but they didn't show up, and no one looked into it for 2 weeks. That's a long time. And that's another part of her legacy that we have to take a look at, which is sustaining ourselves, maintaining connection to family, maintaining connection to friends. If you're working with an activist and suddenly they disappear from sight, pick up the phone and find out how they're doing. This is, if you know someone who's having family problems, take the time to find that out, because all of those things inform our lives. All of those things inform our activism. Myself, when I conduct meetings, I always start with a check-in. It's a habit I've picked up from folks, which is just to, in fact, I didn't do it tonight, I usually do, check in how the room is feeling. How's everybody doing? If you're in a small meeting with a group of people you work with every week, staff meetings, start with a 5-minute check-in. Because the things that are really on our minds, my mother's sick, my cat died, I had a car accident, those are the things that we're carrying. And just to be able to acknowledge them, And then if something needs to be done, we can help each other out with that. Part of the legacy we have to take a look at is that we're humans first, and we're activists second, and our people join movements for companionship as much as they do for politics. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we really need to take a look at ourselves. And that's part of the green. Is that one of the 10 key values? If it's not, it should be. It should be the 11th. sustaining activism.